Hello, and welcome to the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. We bring Bitcoin news, hot topics of conversation, and deep dives into a variety of Bitcoin topics to you weekly. We are Coinbits, a Bitcoin financial services company. Check us out at coinbits.app. This recording is for informational purposes only. No investment or legal or any other advice should be drawn from this content. And as always, consult an advisor before making any legal or financial decisions.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Bitcoin and Chill Friday with the team. This is the Bitcoin Roundup live Twitter space. Thank you all for joining us. We're very grateful today to have Dr. Bull now, Dr. Jeff Ross from Vailshire Capital, joining us to update our macro thesis here on what happens in 2023 with Bitcoin and the broader macro environment. Dr. Ross, hello. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So last time we spoke with Dr. Ross, he was full on Dr. Bear. Late September, Q4, early Q4. And it was doom and gloom everywhere. We were very much in the depth of the bear market and with no clear end in sight. And all kind of just sitting there waiting for something to blow up. And so far, nothing really has. So we're going to see what's going on, where we are today. This is February now, so it's almost been 5 months there. And things look quite drastically different. And we can't wait to pick Dr. Ross's brain on all of that. But before we start, allow me to do a quick introduction. So if you're here joining us for the first time, welcome. Hello. Thank you for joining us. We do these every Friday. This is the Coinbits team. Coinbits is a great way to get exposure to Bitcoin. We're a Bitcoin-only financial services company. Check us out, coinbits.app. And due to popular demand, we've had an ongoing promotion for a while of free Bitcoin DCA. So we made our names in the Bitcoin Roundup product, which is essentially rounding up everyday change from everyday purchases to buy Bitcoin, a very beginner-friendly to get Bitcoin exposure without necessarily actual Bitcoin, I should say, not just a paper Bitcoin, without necessarily feeling like you're investing. So check it out, coinbits.app. And for a limited time, it's going to be free Bitcoin DCA using Roundups. So check it out if you haven't, and this is the first time you're joining us. And now without any further ado, let me start to talk to Dr. Ross. What you're all here joining us here for is what's going on in the when moon, for lack of a better term. Dr. Ross has, again, since last time we spoke with him, has turned on full bull for the time being, at least. But let's tease this out. So Dr. Ross, I wanted to ask you, let's just start with Bitcoin. And, you know, historically, at least in the past couple of years, the Bitcoin rise in price, the Bitcoin price has front ran what we saw in traditional markets. And, you know, Bitcoin price since December at some point was up closer to 40%, with, you know, price today at 22,000, roughly closer to 26.5%, which again is, you know, it's in any other year, this would be considered peak mania, but clearly this isn't every other year. So tell us your thoughts about what gives. Is this dollar weakness? Is this something else? Is this a true start of an actual bear market? Is this a bull trap? What's going on with Bitcoin?
Yeah, lots of great questions that everybody wants to know. And I'd just like to make clear from the start, right? I don't know the answers. These are just my best guesses, and I'm not giving investment advice. So I have to say that kind of stuff. Disclaimers as an investment advisor and a fund manager. But so with that caveat, let me start. I'll say that everything changed. And let me take one more step back. I'm bullish for now. Why do I say I'm bullish for now? First of all, I think everything changed at the very end of September and beginning of October. What changed? Well, you know, I'm a macro guy. I always look from 30,000 feet up to see what's going on and to see what I think is happening across the economic landscape and how that's going to affect different asset classes. At the end of September 30th, to be exact, liquidity contraction, which had been going on throughout all of 2020, finally bottomed. And then we started to actually expand again. And most people don't know that. Just think that quantitative tightening is happening right now by the Fed. But I would argue there's actually stealth QE happening, if that's how you want to think about it. And not just here in the US, but across the world, quantitative easing is actually well underway from a net perspective. So who are the main players? China is actually the kind of player. Japan is also doing some just overt quantitative easing. And then here in the US, like I said, we're actually doing covert quantitative easing. So why does that matter? From a macro perspective, the way I view the world is that all the ebbs and flows of risk assets, and if we're talking, we can talk about like stocks just to get it started. Stocks all trade at a multiple. People know that, right? You can look at price to sales. You can look at price to earnings, price to free cash flow. You can look at all these different kind of metrics, price to book. None of that stuff really matters that much What matters more is if liquidity is expanding in the environment, then the multiples of said equities will expand. And if liquidity in general is contracting, then multiples on stocks and on risk assets will contract. And likewise, I like to call Bitcoin the great absorber of liquidity, or some, you know, some people call it a liquidity sponge. That's a great analogy. Basically, when there's a ton of liquidity amongst institutional investors, commercial banks, you know, pensions, those kind of things, when they have abundant liquidity, they need to put that somewhere. And they don't go out and buy eggs and watch movies with that and buy video games, right? They buy asset classes. So they buy stocks, they buy bonds, they buy real estate, private equity. And in the next cycle, I believe they buy Bitcoin. And so that has major implications. So coming full circle, what happened on November 30th of 2022, liquidity contraction bottomed, and we've been rising ever since. If you go back and look at charts of almost every major asset class, you'll note that marked that time period, right? It's not exactly September 30th, but that time period marked a significant turning point across all asset classes of significance. So the dollar peaked right around there. I believe it was just under 115 that the Dixie had reached. Treasury yields peaked also and have been coming down. They've had a series of lower lows and lower highs since then. Volatility peaked and has been in a different regime since then, I would argue. But risk assets, so you can look at stocks here in the US, you know, it's S&P 500, the NASDAQ, small cap stocks, doesn't matter. All of those basically bottomed in October and have been increasing ever since. You can look internationally as well, Chinese stocks, emerging market stocks, European stocks all bottomed in that time period and have been increasing ever since. And I think it's real. So getting to your question, is this a bull trap? I don't think so. I think this is real. Why? Because liquidity is still increasing. I was a little bit nervous, I will tell you, because the Treasury General ripped higher over the last couple of weeks. It actually just changed finally as of yesterday, but the previous 2 weeks it ripped higher. I didn't expect that because of the debt ceiling. It wasn't supposed to be able to do that, at least as far as I knew. And so they increased that by about $220 billion. I think that's why we've had such a dramatic pullback personally. But yesterday afternoon just confirmed that has decreased again. So liquidity is back to net expansion mode here in the U.S.
That is a really interesting perspective. I think to your point, you know, every major news outlet, the Fed speakers and every single macro commentator hasn't really made much ado about how and if, you know, expansion's happening. We've been lulled to sleep, I think, by Jerome Powell's hawkishness and thinking that we're actually contracting the money supply and that the liquidity, and that doesn't seem to be the case. It's really interesting that you know the time frame you mentioned, because I'm looking here at 10-year and 2-year treasury yields, and they got, you know, they were still on a rip up until November, and then since November is when it started to slow down. So I wonder if there's just like a delay in the bond market reaction to available liquidity, because, you know, you would think that as liquidity is tightening, the bond market would continue to bid higher, which was the case basically through November, at least looking at 10 years. Now, I wanted to ask you about a very specific point you made, which I think might be the case. Well, let me know what you think, but I think personally might be the case through 2023 and this stealth QE mode that seems to be happening. How does that actually work? How do we extend liquidity without making it obvious that liquidity is expanding? Because that's what the Fed essentially is trying to do, right? Because as liquidity increases and inflation stays very sticky high, we'll get into inflation more specifically later, but how do we do stealth QE here in the US?
Sure. So there, most people think of just one component when they think of QE and QT, right? They think of the Fed's balance sheet. They think of, does the Fed own bonds on its balance sheet? Is the amount of bonds or treasuries and mortgage-backed securities on the Fed's balance sheet, is that increasing or is it decreasing? If it's increasing, what the Fed is doing is they're creating money, right? They're creating bank reserves, giving them to banks, and they're basically buying treasuries in the open market and buying mortgage-backed securities. So they're increasing their balance sheet. That's considered quantitative easing. Tightening is the opposite. So what they're doing is they're allowing those bonds and mortgage-backed securities to roll off of their balance sheet. When that decreases, as it has been doing basically for the past year, that's considered quantitative tightening. But what most people don't understand is there's more to the story. There's a couple other factors to consider. I want to give kudos, by the way, to Darius Dale and to 42 Macro and to Lynn Alden, who both do great work on this. And they basically taught me what I know on this. So kudos to them for pointing this out. And it's a metric I follow pretty closely now. So what other factors are there? I brought up the Treasury General account. So the Treasury has its own account that can rise and fall that they keep on the books. And the easiest way to think about it is it's like their checking account. And if they fill up their checking account, that's sucking liquidity out of the system, out of the investable system, out of investable assets, and sucking it into the government, into the Treasury. And if they get rid of that, if they're paying out of their checking account, it's called the Treasury General account, that's adding liquidity to this. Okay, so that's number two. Number three is the overnight reverse repo market. So basically institutional, like commercial banks, institutional investors, they have the ability to park money overnight with the Fed and receive a return on that capital, which is basically a risk-free, right? So whatever the Fed funds rate is, they can park their excess capital, their excess liquidity in the overnight reverse repo market and earn that yield. And they have no risk on that. But if they think they can go out and generate more yield elsewhere and have a good risk return profile, they'll pull money out of the overnight reverse repo market and put that in further out on the risk curve into stocks, into bonds, you know, that we talked about, private equity, real estate, and soon to be Bitcoin. So that generally is good for risk assets when the overnight reverse repo market is declining in value. Right now, that's sitting a little above $2 trillion. It's not an insignificant amount of money. So you have to factor all these three things in. So yes, the Fed's balance sheet is decreasing. That's considered tightening. But over the last week, as I just tweeted out yesterday afternoon, because those results just came out, and let me pull that tweet up just so I can say the correct numbers. So over the last week, the Federal Reserve's their balance sheet decreased by $26 billion. That's tightening. But the Treasury General account decreased also by $67 billion. That's money that's going into the markets, basically, into the investable asset bucket and out of the government. And then the reverse repo market actually increased by a small amount, by $9 billion. So net, you look at all of those things, and what we got was $32 billion of expansion in liquidity over the last week. That's the first time it's expanded. The 2 weeks prior to that, it had been contracting substantially because of the Treasury General account. So this all sounds like probably just nonsense to most people and accounting gimmicks, but what it really is, there more liquidity or not? Most people think that it's people, like we think individuals. They think, oh, probably me, because I'm a fund manager or I'm an investment advisor. Maybe I move markets when I buy things. I don't, you guys. Like, it literally has no effect when I buy things. If I buy 100 shares of Starbucks, I promise you that's not affecting the price of Starbucks one bit. But what does move markets? When institutional investors are putting billions of dollars in the S&P 500 or in Tesla or in whatever, you know, ARK, or pick a stock, that definitely does move the direction of markets. So as that institutional liquidity is increasing, the asset classes, risk assets, tend to flow in that direction as well. So hopefully that makes sense. That's why I'm bullish, even though there are tons of reasons to be bearish right now. Trust me, I know. I think we're due for a credit collapse at some point. I understand that credit standards are tightening across banks. I understand it's getting worse, not better. But for the meantime, it's a bull market until proven otherwise.
Dr. Ross, that's a really good explanation of the repo markets. And the first I personally heard of the repo market specifically, and you know, we'll go back to the other topics you mentioned, but that one is most interesting to me because before COVID, right, and a lot of people who may not have been paying attention at the time and maybe only started paying attention to global macro after the pandemic and the aftershocks didn't know, was Caitlin Long. I remember she was talking with, I think, either Peter McCormick or Preston Pish. This is in like September or October, again, before COVID was even a thing. And she was warning about the repo market, and something seemed to have broken in that fall of 2019. And the repo market was basically the first indication where she was looking and seeing how, you know, how the market is reacting there. And the general consensus at the time was, well, banks are worried about loaning money to each other and therefore parking it at the Fed instead. And that's when I first heard of the repo market, and then, you know, very slowly here trying to understand it. And thank you for making it make so much more sense with the brief introduction you gave to it today. Now, is that a general directional switch that we're starting to see? Like, is it possible for that to quickly reverse directions when banks all of a sudden and other, you know, other financial institutions start to park money back at the Fed to get that interest? Like, is this a V-shaped type reaction where all of a sudden the repo market starts to head in one direction, it's reversing course? Or can this kind of go back and forth for quite some time before, you know, it's full on, hey, like, let's get the money working somewhere else other than getting the Fed funds?
Yeah, that's a great question. So like most markets and like most assets, nothing goes up or down in a straight line, right? So what I'm trying to do is capture the overall trend. Where is it moving on a monthly and quarterly and annual basis? To me, that's what matters the most. I try to drown out the sort of day-to-day moves. So to answer your question, in the near term, the reverse repo market, those figures are by the Fed every day. So every business day, they update those figures. So you'll see it squiggling up and down. It's $8 billion here, you know, minus $12 billion here. It goes up and down. But in overall, it peaked way back, as I mentioned, right around that September 30th time period. The reverse repo market at the time, I believe, was at about $2.4 trillion. And one little caveat, by the way, at the end of the year, this is another thing I've learned in doing a little studying. The last day of the year, December 30th was this year. It was the Friday this year. And I think back in 2021, December was the last day of the year. The reverse repo market spikes on those days. So that kind of throws off the data for a little bit. My guess is it's just because institutions don't want to take any chances as we roll over to a new year. So they park a lot of money there just for that one day. So you have to sort of fatten and actually just get that day out of there to see what the longer trends are doing. So in general, the reverse repo market, like I said, spiked at the end of September, and it's been on a kind of a steady decline ever since. It's now sitting at around 2.05 trillion, I believe, down from a peak of about 2.4 trillion. So that's sizable, right? That's what, 350 billion that's into the system now and flowing into risk assets instead of just being parked in a super safe overnight loan. So that's how I look at that trend. I think will continue. I think what's going to steal the show though for the next several months has to do with this debt ceiling debate, a debacle, what I call it, theatrical debacle going on in the US. It's just nonsense, right? And we all know the ceiling is eventually going to get raised. It is what it is. There is no real ceiling. I like to call the debt ceiling clouds in the sky. It looks like it's a ceiling, but you can just poke right through it and there's nothing to it. So the debt ceiling doesn't even really exist. It's just theatrics. But since we've reached kind of the debt limit, the Treasury is forced to do funny things. They actually have to decrease their general account as we're up to that ceiling. So the billions of dollars that they have on their balance sheet and their checkbook, if you will, I expect that to decline at a pretty substantial clip over the next few months. That should help with net liquidity. That should mean that net liquidity should expand in general over the coming months, especially until the debt ceiling debate is resolved.
Lots of moving pieces and and the fact that the Fed is updating the repo market numbers daily is enough to put people on edge who are looking at this every day. I can imagine that that's not a fun chart to look at every day, trying to guess where things are going. And thank you for sharing all that. I think one additional thought here. So you're talking about liquidity, global liquidity in general, rising. One thing I think we've observed is that, at least for now, the S&P 500 nearly, that just the proxy for risk assets, S&P 500 is typically considered, you know, a good proxy, I think, hasn't nearly kept up with how Bitcoin's price action has behaved. So for example, you know, I think at the end of December, it looks like the S&P 500 closed around 3,800 or so. And as of a couple of days ago, it was at around 4,100. I don't know what the number is off the top of my head today, but that's, you know, that's a nice increase, you know, a few percentage points, not nearly the 25%+ increase that Bitcoin price has seen. Do you think that's just Bitcoin's liquidity magnet, free market, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, essentially just being the absorber of liquidity of essentially first and eventually last resort? Or is there something else going on where, you know, the stock market and broader risk assets aren't performing nearly as well as Bitcoin that might be called in?
Yeah, great question. Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think that Bitcoin was supposed to have bottomed in October along with all of the other risk assets that I mentioned. But because of the debacle with Scam Bank and fraud and FTX and all that stuff, that sucked it down, right? It pulled down the entire crypto community with it and Bitcoin, which was unfortunate. But at that point, I think Bitcoin was so obnoxiously undervalued. It was already undervalued leading up to that point. And so it had a lot of making up to do. So I think part of the reason why it has excelled so much since that time, since November, is just a reversion to the mean, right? And then also Bitcoin in general tends to have more beta than stocks do. So if stocks are going up, Bitcoin in general will go up even more. And then on the contrary, if stocks are going down like they did throughout 2022, Bitcoin will go down even more. So I think that's the playbook still for this entire next decade. I think it will be like that until Bitcoin kind of reaches, it gets past the point of price discovery and gets more into a stable asset and, you know, a stable unit of account. We'll see less volatility at the time. The gains will be less exciting for sure, but there'll also be less volatility. So it comes with pros and cons.
Yeah, for sure. And you had me cracking up here when you said that I was obnoxiously undervalued. I think a couple of days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, we had a tweet thread about Bitcoin's true price, basically, given the world state and what its fair market value would be. And that right now would be $67,427,386. That number seems random to you. It's not. We wrote a thread about it. And essentially, you know, all the things that act as store of value and wealth in the world add up to greater than 1.3 quadrillion and there isn't, you know, there's not an exact number there, but we know that it's north of that number, and that's how much each Bitcoin would be worth at that number. So until we hit that number, I think we're going to be undervalued for quite some time. The difference between the, you know, here and there is essentially adoption, like you were saying. So Dr. Russell, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Fed. And so the Fed's demeanor and language over the past couple of weeks has really shifted. I mean, they got a nice break and lots of data between December FOMC meeting and the FOMC meeting of last week. And so they had a whole lot of new data come in, but I don't think the amount of data that came in was really the only thing that has shifted their sentiments. But, you know, our friends, Joe Consorti and Bhatia from the Bitcoin Layer, they did a really good take on this. And I think you were with them live during the FOMC meeting. They held a Twitter space and you guys were all talking about this. I mean, they essentially changed their language significantly. And subsequent to the FOMC meeting and the press conference, Jerome Powell hasn't really walked back any of his dovish. The market, you know, essentially took what was said in the language that was used as dovish, or as dovish can be, I guess, all things considered. So does, you know, what is it, based on all the things that you're seeing and the implications of the speech at the FOMC and since, what is the market implied rate pathway for the rest of the year?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, first of all, it's really funny how people interpret. I've been in several rooms discussing Powell and his comments afterwards. Some people interpreted him as being extremely hawkish. And so, you know, it is subjective, definitely. So it just depends on what kind of you glom onto. I would say that it was hawkish, but tilted dovish is the best way to think about it. So, it, you know, instead of just being flat hawkish, it's the rate of change is starting to tilt towards dovishness from a deeply hawkish view. Why do I say that? You know, he did use the term disinflation either 11 or 13 times. I can't remember how many times, but quite a few times. So basically saying we've reached peak inflation. We're in this period of disinflation now, which is just declining inflation growth. It's still growing. I like to make that clear to people. It's still growing, but it's growing at a slower rate. And if you have a hard time understanding that, it's if you're driving down the highway going 80 miles an hour, but then you let your foot off the gas a little bit, and now you're going 70 miles an hour, you're still moving forward, but it's at a slower rate. So hopefully that makes sense. That's what disinflation is. You know, he talked about, he thinks that in the second half of the year, we're going to see significant disinflation because basically the owner's equivalent rent will be factored in significantly at that point. That's one of the main sticky things that's holding up CPI right now. The other thing which he didn't talk about, which I think is significant, is that they're also changing the way they calculate CPI. We just saw an example of that with unemployment, right? With the results that just came out, everybody was flipping out because it was way stronger than they had expected. It was like a 9 sigma deviation event, which is crazy. But they completely changed the way that they do things. They updated statistics. They updated underlying metrics. They changed some things. To me, that's like saying, okay, we're going to have a football game now, but instead of the usual 100-yard field, we're going to have a 120-yard field, and we're going to narrow it by half. And instead of having, you know, whatever they have, 11 players on the field, you can only have 6 now. And okay, who's going to win now based on last year's records? And you don't know because you can't compare them. You're playing a completely different game. So with the unemployment stats that just came out that everybody says were just shockingly strong, to me, that's sort of a red herring because they changed the rules. So why do I say that? Because CPI, they're changing the rules. So don't be surprised to see a markedly different number. I personally think it's going to be markedly lower. It's going to surprise the market to the downside. And I think that will be positive for risk assets. But I know a lot of smart people that actually think the opposite. They think inflation is sticky high. They think it's going to be around for longer, and we'll see. Certainly, I would say the markets are pricing that in, right? So what did he say initially? He tilted dovish. The markets took that as extremely dovish. They ripped on those days. That was a good week. And last Thursday, we got to the point of hugely overbought across risk assets. And then since then, they've been pulling back. They've been consolidating. I think that this time, come Tuesday, the 14th, when they talk about January CPI with the new metrics, I wouldn't be surprised if it was a surprise to the downside. And after this big pullback, we see risk assets take off again because we'll go again from being concerned about inflation to not being as concerned about inflation. We may have that kind of Goldilocks period, we get a Goldilocks period. I hate using that term because CNBC uses it too, but it's a good way to describe it. When the Fed pauses their rate hike, so when they're no longer concerned about inflation running away and they can just pause, which I think they do at either 5 or 5.25% federal funds rate, what happens then is risk assets basically always historically have taken off from there. I call it the Fed pause rally. That can last either for a short time or for a pretty long time. The last time of significance that it happened was back in 2006. From 2006 in the summer to October of 2007, the Fed paused their rate hike cycle basically for a year in there, and the NASDAQ stocks actually ripped higher 53% over that kind of 14-month period before they began their big descent lower and had that recessionary bear market. I wouldn't be surprised if we had the same sort of deal this time around, although I think it's going to go faster just because the Fed is moving faster and markets anticipate things more quickly. I think that's what the market is seeing. Anytime the Fed or Jerome Powell seems to be tilting dovish with their talks about inflation, with their talks about hiking the federal funds rate, risk assets really glom onto that and they get ready to rip because they've been beaten down so much. So I would expect more of that. Expect like NASDAQ stocks, small cap stocks, growth, innovation, you know, Cathie Wood's ARK things, Tesla, Bitcoin too, even though it's not a risk asset, crypto, all of that stuff would catch a bid if the Fed truly does pause. Now, I wanted to make one thing clear. That doesn't mean it's blue skies, open skies ahead of us. It still means that somewhere down the road, we probably have an early bear market to deal with. At some point, there's a credit event and the Fed will be forced to pivot and start lowering rates. That's always bad. And that's bad for risk assets and not even risk assets, but just all like even safe haven assets get destroyed in those time periods. And there's almost nowhere to hide other than cash. Excuse me. That's what has happened previously. That's not something to look forward to. And I still think, though, it's something that lies ahead of us. So bullish for now. That's why I say for now, because that for now part means that at some point things are going to get ugly again and the Fed is to rapidly lower rates.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there to react to. I mean, I think every metaphor in every previous time something like this has taken place, it's not exactly the same. Things don't always play out exactly the same and each event is its own thing. But I think trying to draw comparisons, I mean, like Michael Burry famously this week has activated and deactivated and tweeted and deleted tweets so many times. And he's definitely stuck in, hey, this is the 2006 all over again framework. And, you know, nobody can blame her for it, given how successful he was playing that entire scenario. But it's definitely not 2006 all over again. And there's so many moving parts and so many variables that impact how things can play out here that it's hard to predict. And it's not going to be an exact parallel to any other inflation, disinflation, recession of the past. So it's interesting to see this play out in real time. I mean, again, last time we spoke with you, I mean, we were sitting here looking at Credit Suisse, and is Credit Suisse going to crash? And is that going to be the Lehman Brothers moment of 2022? And that wasn't the case. And here we are sitting in on a cusp of what could be a prolonged or at least temporarily prolonged bull market, and it doesn't necessarily play out the same. So what does that mean, though, for 2023? I mean, if we're looking at different metrics and different implications for federal funds rate, what does that look like for 2023? I think last time I checked this, and I think again it was shout out to the Bitcoin Layer, they produced these awesome charts in their newsletter. You should check it out if you're here listening and interested in general macro as a whole. But you know, they produce these charts, and I think the federal funds implications based on market performance and market behavior is essentially, like you're saying, around maybe another hike or so, you know, a quarter of a basis point, and 25 basis points, quarter percent, and then pause, and then cuts by the end of the year. Is that what the market's still telling us today?
So yes, it is assuming that. It's basically saying that it looks like the Fed funds rate will get somewhere between 5 and 5.25%. So we'll see if it does. That's my take on it too. I think that they do end up keeping it up there for longer, unless, I always like to have this caveat, unless there's a credit event will trigger them to, they're going to start lowering rates faster because they're going to need to do it out of panic mode. But if they have, like, say the economy continues to sort of chug along, we don't have any major credit event, then yeah, I think they'll hold that rate at that, you know, 5 or 5.25% for quite some time, possibly through the end of 2023. In the meantime, I don't really care that much. I don't hang my hat on what inflation is going to do because I don't invest in inflation. I invest in assets that are moved by inflation, but I don't really like to make predictions on it. I think both arguments are persuasive. The one for sticky inflation where it remains surprisingly high. I lean more though towards the disinflation camp. I think by the time the OER really kicks in the second half of the year, I wouldn't be surprised, especially and also with how we calculate the CPI being a little bit different going forward. I think that it's possible CPI is sort of in the 2 to 4% range by the end of the year, and it's just not really a concern anymore at that point. Now, it may continue to be inflamed and be volatile throughout this decade. Well, that remains to be seen. But for this year, I think by the end of the year, it will be less of a concern and people won't care about it as much. So we'll either have a big kind of deflationary type event like we did in Q4 2008 and Q1 2009, or we just sort of have more of a gentle decline. You know, Powell, for all the flack people give him, he's been pretty on with lots of the things that he says going to do. He does manage expectations fairly well now. I think he learned from his 2018 debacle where he had to pivot and he felt pretty stupid, I'm sure. But he's doing a pretty good job. The markets don't panic when he talks now. So when he says that we'll probably see some healthy disinflation as the OER component kicks in the second half of 2023, I'm inclined to believe him. And I don't really have any other data that suggests otherwise. So again, I don't make any investment decisions based on that. I might be totally off on that, but I'm just going to follow my momentum indicators and other factors for my own investment decisions.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think part of the reason why he has been so good at managing expectations is because they're essentially an open book now. I mean, they have these blackout periods where none of the FOMC voters are allowed to speak for, I think, is it like a week or a week and a half prior to FOMC meetings. But, you know, that's, we all know the name of the gentleman that took their decisions ahead of time. And he works for the Wall Street Journal, Nick. I don't know how to say his last name. They're an open book and they try not to surprise the markets. And, you know, part of managing expectations is telling the markets exactly what you're going to do before you do it. I think that's a big piece of it. But the interesting thing that, you know, that I think hasn't really materialized just yet is the data they look at. And I think one of the things that they look at, the Fed is looking at and speaking about a lot, is the job market. And, you know, it's the job market so far on the whole hasn't really seen a massive drop off. And, you know, we've seen a lot of layoffs, primarily tech companies and what you would classify generally as more risk-based companies, but we haven't really seen it in a broader economy just yet. And a lot of the jobs that are coming back are, you know, there's various takes on this. I was curious about your take, but essentially the jobs that were lost to COVID are essentially coming back in a slow but steady approach. And that's what's keeping the job market healthy. But we have record low unemployment right now. The Fed is looking at that and saying, hey, there's not enough people that are unemployed, right? We need to bring down inflation. And that's been their general gist of conversation over the past few months. We can continue to hike rates because the unemployment is still historically low and we're trying to tame inflation. So what could happen in the jobs market? You know, how many mass layoff events would we need to see for the Fed to, you know, seriously start to consider pausing earlier or not holding interest rates as high as they can be or as they'd like to hold them to be while the job market cools off?
Yeah, so lots of great discussion points there. First, what we talked about earlier, right? The way that the Fed and they've changed the way that they calculate unemployment. So you have to take the recent statistics with a grain of salt or with a big asterisk next to it. It doesn't really compare. It's not totally comparable. So that's caveat number one. Number two is there are a couple of things. First of all, I always like to bring up from the huge 30,000 foot view again. That's, I like to look top down. If you look at unemployment from the long term, unemployment in the U.S. peaked way back in the year 2000, and it's been on a really strong and steady decline since then. Why is that? Because the baby boomer population, which had, you know, tons of workers, both male and female workers, you know, female workers that really blossomed in the last couple of decades of the last century, all of that peaked, and boomers now have all basically reached retirement age and are getting out of the workforce. The cohorts behind the boomers were much smaller, generally speaking. The millennial cohort's pretty big, but there's not as many workers in the millennial cohort and in Gen Z too. They just don't have the same number of workers, I guess is the best way to put it. So that's on a slow and steady decline. And then on top of that, we had COVID, as you brought up, and it wasn't COVID itself. It was the response to COVID, right? The shutting down of businesses, the forcing people out of work, and then the transfer payments to the people who were unemployed. So that really changed the dynamics of employment as well, right? If you're just sitting at home and you could like, well, I could go get a job at McDonald's or I could sit home, play video games and get free checks from the government. I think I'll take plan B, right? Until that money runs out. So we've been on that schedule for a couple of years. That's obviously starting to wane now. But then there's the next thing, and Paul actually even brought this up too. We do have a permanent loss of the workforce. and probably related to COVID, who either got genuinely sick and have chronic illness, or people who are psychologically traumatized, whether or not that's legitimate or not is a different discussion, but who just won't go back to work for whatever reason. So they may be permanently lost to the workforce. So that's another issue. So those are all my caveats then to say, I don't really care about the record low unemployment, because as we do head into a recession, that number will spike, and it will spike quickly. I think we're seeing signs of that already. Interestingly, it's basically been across Silicon Valley, like tech companies. Also, interestingly, they tend to make way more money. So it's like a high level problem. It doesn't affect the lower class in lower income classes as much. And if you think about it, how that works, right? Say you're working at Google, you were making $250K a year doing whatever you were doing. They probably give these guys like a 6-month deal where they can get paid for 6 months. It's pretty nice. They can, you know, they still get all their benefits for a season. They can take their time looking for work. So I would say a lot of those layoffs have been announced, but we won't really see that reflected in the unemployment numbers still for several more months. I do, you know, just from looking out, a large number of layoffs were announced in January. Now they were just announced, but they haven't happened yet. So that still has to happen. And then those people still have to go out and actually look for work. And that will start, and then it will start affecting those statistics. So as we know, unemployment is the laggingest of lagging indicators heading into a recession. At some point, I do expect it to spike. Again, I don't know if we're going to have a soft or a hard recession. I would lean towards hard, but I don't know the answer to that. But we'll know it when we see it. So it depends. If unemployment spikes and spikes really hard, we can brace ourselves for a hard landing. And if it doesn't spike too much, we may actually get away with a soft landing.
That is very hopeful. I'm not as hopeful as you, Dr. Ross, but it's just taking a step back and thinking about the Federal Reserve's mandates, right? And it's what they try to achieve, right? They're trying to achieve two things for those who may not be aware, right? Their dual mandate is maximum employment. And there's all kinds of issues with that because technology is deflationary. And realistically, if we're advancing as a civilization, as humans, we should have maximum unemployment, but that's another story. And their other mandate is stable prices. Now, you know, the general longstanding belief that the Fed is operating under, and, you know, there's different ways of measuring this, and there's all kinds of fiat science, as Saifedean likes to call it, that goes into this. But the longstanding belief is that a job market that has strong hiring, higher wages, you know, and the like, typically fewer is higher inflation. And so if you're trying to fight inflation, right, given that framework, given that thinking, what you want to try to do is maximize unemployment. And so, of course, that, you know, that's the rock and the hard place that the Fed is generally stuck in between. And to try to balance the two perfectly, given the complex nature of the global economy, even when the Fed was created over 100 years ago, that, you know, that's always proven to be an impossible task. And the idea of a soft landing in today's complex, multifaceted global economy is even more laughable. But that's, you know, that's the idea. And so the Fed is going to try to erode progress on the unemployment side, unfortunately, in order to get inflation under control. That's the playbook, right? That's the tools that are in their repertoire. That's what, you know, that's what raising interest rates produces, right? Is it makes it harder for employers, right? People that are after the money to try to grow their business to get money. And so that usually means cuts. And the fastest way an employer can cost is obviously their HR, right? They're hiring people and hiring freezes, et cetera. But that hasn't materialized yet. And actually, I think there's an interesting stat another day, and I don't know if Dr. Ross, you know this off the top of your head. Sorry to spring this up on you. If you don't know, we could always update the listeners here later. But I think every time that we've had a major recession, we've had maximum employment shortly before. And I think that was the case in the 2006, the last major recession, and prior to that in the 80s. And so it's an interesting, you know, it's almost like history repeat itself, but it sure has those here and there. And I wonder if that's what's going to happen here with employment. But that's the framework the Fed is working under. And that's why they look at employment so closely. And the idea is landing, again, in relation to these two mandates, and correct me if I'm wrong, is you slow down employment just enough to bring down inflation, supposedly. And of course, inflation is not just based on employment, but that's what the Fed is able to control. And when you bring it down just enough, employment just enough to bring inflation down, then you can try to even things out again and cancel out employment losses, and now inflation's under control. Of course, this is that's the tightrope that they're trying to walk, but who knows if they can actually pull it off.
Yeah, it's very bothersome to me, right? It's such a crazy way to treat a problem. Because demand is the one thing they can control, they can't fix the supply side of things. That's more of a, you know, that's a fiscal response, not a central bank monetary response. because they can control demand, that's all they do. And they go after it hardcore and they go after it 100%. And they talk about it like it's some great, you know, great goal to achieve. But what they're really doing in this demand destruction, they're literally, as you're bringing up to your point, trying to get people to lose their jobs. And that sucks, right? I mean, if you're a regular person and you want to work and you can barely afford your groceries and your gas and your bills currently, like to know that the Fed is actively trying to destroy demand so that you get fired is, I think, really frustrating and really backwards looking and really crazy. I mean, that's what a centrally planned communist government would decide to do. Rather, what should be happening, and I've said this before, and I'm sorry about going off, and I'm not, this isn't me being political. I'm not into politics at all. I despise it, actually. What should be happening is we should be doing everything to increase the supply side, right? We should be increasing work. We should be increasing supply of goods and services. We should be doing all of that to strengthen the U.S. not only in the short term, but over the long run. And this demand destruction actually just hurts us in the short run and in the long run. It's such a crazy way to go about solving this, quote, inflation problem. I can't stand it personally. It gets me really aggravated. But to your point, you are correct that unemployment always does reach basically record lows just as we head into a recession. So it's very ironic that Powell and Fed officials would use that as, oh, no, the economy is strong. Look, look, because that's always literally, it's the sign, it's the laggingest of indicators, as I said. That's literally the final domino that has to fall. Once that turns and starts heading higher, we basically know that we're in a recession and they know that they've gone too far at that point. And then it's just a matter of how bad is the destruction going to be? How bad is the recession? And I think that's what we have to look forward ahead of us sometime in 2023 or 2024.
Yeah. And I think, you know, given where we were in 2022, we were expecting things to play out a lot faster than they have with regards to what a recession could look like and how long it would take to get there. But employment is the sticky part. And as long as people are employed and they have money, and I think that's the case right now, and that's the reason that the Fed has any confidence in continuing to raise rates and talk about holding rates higher for longer, I think that quickly goes away as soon as, you know, employment starts to tick up, or sorry, unemployment starts to tick up beyond a specific limit. Now, speaking of demand and demand destruction, the other big element of this that, you know, might be, again, very different than 2006 is, or 2008, I should say, is the housing market. So over the past, you know, more or less all of 2022, there's a big slowdown, and primarily driven by interest rates going up. Not just interest rates, we hadn't seen housing pricing from the 2021 QE-driven, you know, historic rise in housing prices. So you had two things happening there. You had housing prices going up tremendously because of QE and other, you know, other factors. And also interest rates going up. And that has significantly slowed down the housing market, but not nearly to the level that you would think it. And actually, we're even seeing signs. I think it was earlier this week that CNBC released something on what's happening there. But yeah, mortgage rates had more than doubled from historic lows. Home prices have been sticky high, and they were higher even in December. The latest readings had them higher, 6.9% higher year over year over 2021. Now, that, again, even though that number sounds crazy, that was actually the lowest annual appreciation rate since 2020. And, you know, for example, last April, annual price appreciation had hit a high of 20% year over year. So as we're seeing, you know, again, these are very dynamic things. So we're looking at unemployment and it's historically low, but we're also looking at housing prices, and they were essentially, I mean, they still are historically high, and mortgage rates are historically high. And so those two combination of factors, if we start to see a flip, things can go down in a hurry. So is the Fed, do you think, concerned at all with housing markets? And is this going to be, you know, especially what we're seeing now, is this going to continue to play out as long as we're in a bull market where the housing market starts to show early signs of life again, especially into the spring season here? Typically, that's when the housing market is at its highest. How does this play out, and what potential impact can that have on future QE?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, obviously, I don't know, right? But if I were in Powell's head and if I had to guess, I would say he's pretty pleased so far with what's happened with housing, right? There hasn't been a major catastrophe. I think that clearly real estate had reached highly excessive levels, like historically high valuation levels, because everybody was using housing again as speculation like they did back in 2006 to 2008, that time period, not to the same degree, right? Not with the subprime mortgage crisis, but still it had gotten quite excessive. I would say he's pleased. I would say that he's basically sucked a lot of that excess liquidity and leverage out of the system, and that it's sort of more reasonably priced now. Now, people are still priced out of houses because of the mortgage rates that are high, because prices have not come down quite enough yet. I think what we're going to see for the next several months is we're still going to see prices continue to down a bit, though not at the same rate of change, so it won't be as dramatic. And then, yeah, if we see that, you know, the long end treasury yields, 20 and 30 years, continue to decline the rates, we'll see mortgage rates come down even further, and that should start to awaken that. Now, as you know, I mean, the housing is like a sleeping giant. It takes a long time to move in either direction, but when it does, it really goes with that momentum for quite a while. So I still think for the majority of this year, that downward price pressure is going to be the story, even if interest rates, even if mortgage rates continue to creep down a little bit. I don't think it basically came to a standstill in 2022. I think we'll see signs of life in 2023, but I'm actually optimistic about housing, especially in the terms of like first-time home buyers, people who need to buy a house, that they'll actually have reasonably priced houses from finally, and a mortgage that they can afford. Like maybe the 30-year mortgage rate settles at like 4.5% to 6%, somewhere in there, but housing prices drop another 10 to 20%. They're going to be able to find some reasonable deals, and people are actually going to find, you know, reasonable housing at that point. And hopefully it will have flushed most of the speculators away. And so I think Powell is probably a bit optimistic about that. He sounds optimistic when again, he's talking about the CPI and the owner's equivalent rent, which, by the way, for people who don't know, that's basically the prices of houses 12 to 15 months ago. That has about a 12 to 15 month delay on the owner's equivalent rent component that goes into the CPI. And so he's looking back and saying, okay, about, you know, 6 to 12 or more months ago, housing was near a peak and it's over. And so when we look ahead to the second half of 2023, that should be reflected in the CPI. We should start seeing lower CPI numbers. So that's a really long-winded answer to say, I think Powell is probably pleased. I don't think he's concerned about housing at the moment. I'd say if anything, he's probably patting himself on the back.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you mentioned, you know, hopefully there being good deals for people who are first-time home buyers and homeowners, and then people who actually need it and aren't looking to buy housing for investment property, which is a good chunk of the housing market today. Hopefully they're also employed to be able to afford a mortgage. That sounds like, you know, 4.5% sounds magical right now, but, you know, not if you're unemployed. But hopefully that does play out that way and people are able to get the housing that they need. All right, Dr. Oz, you've been going for some time and I know your time is limited. So I want to just throw out here a couple of scenarios at you that would cause maybe a shift to your current thinking, unexpected, what I'll call, you know, black swan type events that might cause, you know, a shift one way or the other. And I'm curious about your reaction to some of these. We've seen in the global, you know, political and world environments, rising tensions between countries, certain countries. I won't go into specifics, but what is the implication of another or expansion of the current hot war? What if more countries get involved, and what if it really turns into type of World War III that is more than just words and actually turns into a hot war? How would that impact your overall thesis for 2023?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously bad news. That would be bad for risk assets. Historically, anytime a new war is announced, risk assets do really poorly in the short term. And usually once the war gets underway and basically people get used to it, markets find a bottom and then they start to increase again from there. That's happened historically with most major wars. So say something did get announced here in the next month or something, what would I expect? I would expect risk assets to sell off. I would expect Bitcoin to sell off, even though it's not a risk asset. I would expect volatility to increase and the dollar to increase because people would be selling their assets for dollars. People would probably flock to treasuries, although that's not as obvious as it once was. But those are the kind of the main things that I would be watching for. It would be definitely a negative for risk assets in general.
Makes sense. That's historically how things have played out. What if we get people who follow the World Economic Forum have been listening to them warn about a cyber pandemic for quite some time now? What if we get something akin to a cyber pandemic that, I mean, who knows, that we've never had a cyber pandemic before? But what if we get something like that where there's a major outage in some major infrastructure, internet infrastructure organization that causes major disruption in how information flows across the internet? How would that play out potentially?
Yeah. So again, same kind of thing, right? So anytime a new event, a black swan event comes out, what the first thing people do is they panic. And when people panic, they sell. So they would sell their risk assets. So again, we would see a spike in the dollar. I would imagine a spike in volatility. and a decrease across the board in risk assets, and unfortunately a decrease in Bitcoin too, even though it's not a risk asset. And then it would get, you know, it'd get figured out at some point. And by the way, you know, the WEF literally basically just pre-announced that this is going to happen. So I would just tell people, buckle up for it. It's going to happen. Like, they're just telling you it's going to happen. I'm becoming more and more of a tinfoil hat guy by the day when I listen to these people speak. It's pretty incredible, the ideas that they have and the control they seem to be able to exert over the rest of humanity is sickening to me. And so I would tell people, just as an aside, to defund Davos by buying Bitcoin. That's one way to defund what they're doing. Defund dystopia with Bitcoin as well. That's another thing to do. So if you want to proactively find a way to fight against that, because it's otherwise impossible to that, right? They have a monopoly on power. There's nothing we can really do about it, but we can defund them with a sly roundabout way, and the way is Bitcoin.
Yeah, for sure. And honestly, I don't think it's tinfoil hat anymore. I think it's just looking at facts and reacting to the facts. So anyway, so let's move on. So what if we have black swan events? The other, let's say, I mean, we've been waiting for this and nothing has really materialized yet. But what if we get a major financial institution meltdown, or on the same side of that token, what if we get, and who knows how long this takes to materialize or if it ever materializes, what if we get a no bid treasury auction where essentially nobody wants to buy, specifically Federal Reserve, I mean, the U.S. government treasury bonds? How would that play out if it ever gets to that?
Yeah, well, we had a little taste of that in March of 2020, if you remember back at during the COVID crisis. Basically, treasuries did go no bid for a little while, and that was pretty wild. And so what happens then is that forces central banks into the market really quickly. That's when panic sets in. That's when it feels like the world is ending, at least from a financial and monetary standpoint. People keep, you know, everybody talks about QE infinity. They can't wait for, you know, QE to start again. I gotta forewarn people though, it's always unpleasant at the beginning. They don't start just leisurely. They start out of panic mode. And that usually means that everything is collapsing and it's really scary out there. And they're sort of forced to do things. They're forced to lower rates really rapidly. They're forced to buy treasuries because treasuries have gone no bid. Nobody else wants to touch them because they're scared of them. So they're forced to buy a lot of them. If that happens, I mean, risk assets would literally get just pummeled. Like the NASDAQ could drop easily 30 to 50% from current levels if something like that were to occur. And so those are the kind of things I watch for. I will tell you right now, like I keep saying, I'm bullish for now. There are no signs of credit stress right now. Slight signs of credit stress, like the treasury credit default swaps, have crept up to like 35 bips. That's really nothing though. And that's, I think it's only because of the theatrics of this debt ceiling nonsense. And once resolved, that the credit default swap level will go back down again. But what I watch more closely is, what is the high yield option adjusted spread doing? When people get concerned, when we're actually heading into a credit type event, people sell the junkiest debt. They sell junk bonds and they usually buy treasuries in general. And so the spread between those two widens. And you can watch that. The Fed has that. And that's another chart I look at daily. I'm a nerd. But that's at very relaxed levels right now. Like there are no signs of stress right now in the credit markets. We will know, like it gives you usually a little bit of a warning. If, you know, if not months, you usually have at least a couple of weeks where you can see it start to blow out. That's usually time to batten down the hatches and to get in full defensive mode. And I'm just telling you that I don't see any signs of that at the moment. So I'm not concerned that we're heading into one imminently.
Yeah. And I think that's probably consensus, but you know, these things don't happen until they happen and then everybody's shocked. And, you know, we'll see how that could potentially play out. The last question here, and I think you've answered this, but what if we do have a stalemate with the debt ceiling? And I think, you know, essentially when we have a divided federal government right now, I mean, how long can they be in a stalemate? How long can this actually play out? Obviously, and you know, in the long term, it won't matter. Debt ceiling goes up. It always goes up. It's always theatrics, like you were saying. But what if this prolonged stalemate starts to worry some people, some institutional money managers? Could that have a marked impact on the market?
Yeah, I don't think it would have a marked impact. Nothing like the other events you mentioned, because I think everybody knows it's just theatrics. Everybody knows at some point it's going to get resolved. And so I just think we'll continue to see like the credit default swaps on treasuries just like slightly increase little by little until it's finally resolved. And then it'll sort of go back to normal again. And we'll see a little bit of stress in risk assets. You know, markets don't like uncertainty is the saying. And so as long as there's that uncertainty hanging out there, but I would just say like markets are pretty forward looking. And most people, I think most market participants know that this is just theatrics and that it will be resolved at some point. So I don't really put too much stock into that affecting asset prices in any significant way.
Fantastic. Dr. Ross, thank you very much for spending so much time with us, having this conversation. I have One last question for you, but before I get there, let me just welcome in audience joining us. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you for being here with us. And obviously most of you here to listen to Dr. Ross, not to us, but we do these weekly. We have a conversation. We call it Bitcoin and Chill Friday. We then turn it into a podcast called Bitcoin Roundup Podcast. This is hosted by Coinbits. Check it out. Coinbits.app has a great way to onboard your friends, your family, to particularly those who are worried or scared or watching, you know, the Bitcoin price and they're like, I don't know if I want to dabble into this. I don't want to invest in Bitcoin just yet. Well, Bitcoin Roundup is the product for them. It's a quick way to get Bitcoin exposure without feeling like you're investing. Essentially, you round up every day, purchase change, and roll that to Bitcoin. And so it doesn't feel like investing, but actually you're getting a little Bitcoin at a time. And I think nothing builds Bitcoin knowledge and Bitcoin confidence than owning some. So check us out, coinbits.app. And for a limited time, we have that product, the Bitcoin for free. It's essentially a DCA product. And it's essentially free for anybody who signs up for a new account between now and the end of March. So check us out, coinbits.app. Now, Dr. Ross has had a conversation with us about this exact topic, the global macro environment, back in late September, actually. Dr. Ross, it was actually one day before September 30th, I think it was September 29th, that we had our last conversation, and we almost nailed the timing there for that last conversation. But that conversation is wherever you get your podcasts. It's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. It's also on YouTube. So find us on those channels and listen to our conversations. These Friday conversations that we have get all recorded as podcasts and shared out. And I'll have this one out hopefully in a much quicker time frame than the prior one. But last question here for you, Dr. Ross, before we go. So you had mentioned before, I think it was sometime last year, and maybe your views on this has changed now. And this is not investment advice. This is just you guessing, and you've caveated this plenty before. But what do you think Bitcoin price at the end of 2023 will look like? And if I recall correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, you had anticipated a run-up over 100K, maybe over 200K by the end of 2023, but that was some time ago. So has your thesis on Bitcoin price changed by the end of this year at all?
So what I look at, first of all, predictions are just a fool's errand, right? This is just my best guesses. So I like to caveat that too. I'm definitely wrong when I guess on this, but I like to use demand-based models for Bitcoin. The stock to flow caught a lot of attention a couple of years ago, and that never really sunk in with me very well. I think to me, it makes more sense that it's a demand-based model since we know we have a fixed supply of 21 million Bitcoin. So based on those models and some of the best ones, what I did is combined all of the best demand-based models and said, you know, what would be in kind of a standard market setting of Bitcoin, assuming the normal level of adoption that we're seeing in Bitcoin and the, you know, the increase in hash rate, the increase in strength and security across the network. That model told me, the combined stuff that I look at, that by the end of 2022, so, you know, a month and a half ago, the price should have been around $50,000 based on that model. And then the price should be around $100,000 by the end of 2023. Now, that's with the huge, right? If market conditions are terrible and they continue to deteriorate, then of course we're going to be below that, right? That's sort of the expected number that it should be. And if market conditions are awesome and we have QE infinity happening already underway and we just had a soft landing recession, then I would expect it to be much higher than that. So hopefully that makes sense. So people are like, you know, the model isn't really a price prediction, but it does give you a good idea of how fairly valued or not Bitcoin is. And usually, by the way, I should add, historically speaking, Bitcoin tends to overshoot that. People get, like, I think, too optimistic based on a demand-based model. And we're really early in the adoption phase still, so we still have a long ways to go. So that's my answer. I'd say by the end of 2022, you know, the price of Bitcoin, I can't remember what it was, 16 or 18,000 or something, even though the model was saying 50. So how would I respond to that? Not that I was wrong and the model's broken. I would say that Bitcoin is cheap. And so if Bitcoin at the end of 2023 is substantially under $100,000 per Bitcoin, guess what I'd say? It's super cheap. And so I think it's a good thing to buy if you have a very long-term perspective. So I think any price under 50 to 100K this year is basically a good deal on Bitcoin. That's why I tell people, like, I personally, I do all this trading and investing for my clients. Personally, I just dollar cost average into Bitcoin and don't even think about it, because I think these prices currently are historically very cheap when we look ahead 5 or 10 years.
Absolutely. Very well said. And I think the bigger picture is all the things that we talked about and all the pseudoscience and the fiat manipulation and the games that we listened to for the past hour, that the Fed is trying to control the market and how impossible of a task that is. Bitcoin fixes all of that. And so, you know, a bet isn't necessarily a bet on fiat price going up. It's also a bet that the free market, the market for money, the market for freedom, which is represented by Bitcoin is going to continue to accelerate and gain traction. And that can only mean that the fiat denominated price goes up. But really well said. And I think, again, we had a thread this week. I think it's been up here about Bitcoin's fair market value. Should it actually consume all the store of value and wealth in the world? That's 67 plus million. So anything below that, I would argue, is also still cheap. So Dr. Ross, this was a great conversation. Thank you so much for the insights. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. And for those of you who are joining us here late, this conversation was recorded. Dr. Ross takes us on a variety of different topics regarding macro picture and how the Fed might behave over the next few months and what they've said and what we've seen and how long this bull market or this bull rally will continue for. And you're welcome to listen to the recording as soon as we finish here. One last question. I lied. I have one more question for you, Dr. Ross. I don't know if you're a big American football fan, but who do you have on Sunday, Eagles or Chiefs?
Oh, man. So I guess I'll have, so first of all, I'm not a huge fan. I used to be, but I quit watching sports about 20 years ago. Life was too busy. But if I had to, you know, put a gun to my head, who would I choose? I would vote for the Eagles only because I'm a Broncos fan and the Broncos and Chiefs are in the same division. So I don't like the Chiefs. So I hope the Eagles win but primarily because I want the Chiefs to lose.
I'm a Giants fan myself. So I'm on the flip side of that trade. I'd like to see the Eagles lose, but only because I'm a Giants fan. Can I get you to do one more prediction? What's the score going to be?
Oh, man. Let's see. I think it's going to be a good game and it's going to be fairly close. So I'm going to say that the Eagles win and it's going to be 31-28. You heard it here first.
There you go. 31-28 is a nice last-minute field goal was set up. That sounds good to me. A fun game would be much welcome distraction from all this craziness in the world. So awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ross. We appreciate your time. Thank you for everybody who has joined us here. Again, please give us a check out coinbits.app. And if you are interested in getting some financial advice, Dr. Ross is a financial advisor. Check out Valeshire Capital. If you are not already, for some reason, following Dr. Ross, you should be. He shares his thoughts. I think actually one thing I really appreciate about your takes, Dr. Ross, is that you're not afraid to admit when you were wrong. And actually you caveat that most likely you will be wrong. That's the nature of, you know, trying to make predictions. But, you know, owning it and being clear about why and how your thesis has changed over time, I think is really useful. And it's helpful for people to follow along. So if you're not already following Dr. Feel free to do that. He's pretty active on Twitter. And once in a while, he shares some really useful nuggets. And once in a while, he shares some really funny takes, which I personally appreciate. Dr. Ross, is there any other handoff you'd like to give people before we close out for the
No, that's great. I appreciate you having me on again. It was fun to chat about all this stuff. And I wish everybody well out there. Keep your eyes open. It's going to be an interesting year.
Absolutely. Amazing. Thank you so much again. Enjoy your weekend. And we'll talk again soon. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Have a great rest of your afternoon and have a great weekend.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Bitcoin Roundup podcast presented by Coinbits. So what do you think of the conversation? Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at CoinbitsApp and be sure to subscribe to be notified of our next episode release. Thanks so much for listening and we'll catch you next time on the Bitcoin Roundup podcast.